Hello there, listeners. Last week, Nikki Haley suspended her campaign for the presidency, offering a clear idea of who the GOP nominee would be for the 2024 election. At this point in time, many are asking what a Trump presidency means for our economy, the migration crisis in the South, reproductive rights, and democracy. On my end, I wonder what a Trump presidency would mean for polarization, misinformation, political extremism, and a possible return of QAnon. In today's episode, we explore this question from a psychosocial perspective and perhaps address some of the factors that contributed to the radicalization of many in the U.S. and abroad. Be sure to stick around for my post commentary, as I want to make some corrections about Kazim Kazam's model of conspiracy theories. So with that being said, let's dive in. Hello, listeners. Welcome to this edition of the Social Chemist Podcast. I'm your host, Nelson. And on today's episode, we are joined by Dr. Joseph Pierre, a health science clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of California. His expertise in the clinical field involves working with individuals with psychotic disorders, substance use disorders, and those with dual diagnosis. Apart from that, Dr. Pierre dwells into the realm of conspiracism, where he has published literature reviews on topics such as delusional-like beliefs and their association with conspiracy theories. In today's episode, we'll discuss his contribution to the book The Social Science of QAnon, a New Social and Political Phenomenon, which assesses the Q movement from a psychosocial perspective. Joe, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Joe, I'm going to ask you the same question that I tend to ask a lot of the practitioners that I have on the program, which is, how did you come to the field of conspiracy theories and misinformation, being that as practitioners, we tend to work at the micro level, working with individuals, figuring out the diagnosis and developing a treatment plan? When it comes to conspiracy theories, political extremism, and the QAnon movement, these are what I would consider macro level problems that that affect us at a societal level. How did you come to this field of study?
Well, as you noted, I'm a psychiatrist. My main clinical interest in psychiatry has always been psychotic disorders like schizophrenia. And among the kinds of psychotic symptoms that patients with those kinds of illnesses display, I've always been most intrigued by delusions. And delusions, of course, we could define as fixed false beliefs, like the belief that we're being surveilled by the CIA, or the belief that we're the second coming of Christ. And I've always just found it very fascinating to try to understand what's going on with the brain or the mind or the lives of people that come to believe such things that are so divorced from reality. At the same time, although that's been my clinical interest, I've always been just as fascinated by what I call the gray area between psychosis and normality, where people aren't necessarily mentally ill, but they may not be mentally healthy either. And if we talk about sub-threshold, that is non-clinical beliefs that resemble delusions and fall into that gray area, we call this delusion-like beliefs. And for me, conspiracy theories offer a great example of a delusion-like belief, a very timely example also, that can be distinguished from delusions, but can also be associated with distress and dysfunction, and therefore of interest to me as a psychiatrist. Now, if you want a less technical answer about my interests, I can say that you could probably trace my main interest in conspiracy theories back to just maybe about 6 or 7 years ago when flat earthers were in the news, I think in part thanks to Kyrie Irving talking about them. And so just in the same way that I'm interested in why people believe delusions, I got really curious about how seemingly normal people could believe something so opposite of what we would, what most of us would consider to be a basic science fact. And then in the wake of that flat earth popularity, of course, other more relevant and consequential conspiracy theories like QAnon have cropped up in recent years and have really become part of mainstream awareness. So it was kind of a coincidence and just happened to be a time where I was starting to look into conspiracy theories.
I want to talk a little bit about your categorization of different types of QAnon believers. Now, I'm not sure if you ever read Hussein Kazam's book, Conspiracy Theories, which talks about conspiracy theories as the title suggests. And in his book, he identifies three types of conspiracy theorists: the conspiracy theory consumer, the distributor, and the producer. The consumer is basically anyone who engages in conspiracy theories, which if you look at the studies, is like 70% of the American population. The distributor is the one that will share a conspiracy theory, whether on Instagram or on Facebook, on whatever platform. And then the conspiracy theory producer are the ones that gain income from whatever narrative they're being, that they're spreading. The first person that comes to mind is like Alex Jones, Peter Stu, Nick Fuentes, these individuals that make a profit off the conspiracy theories. When it comes to QAnon, you also offer a model of the different types of conspiracy theorists. Can you help explain or differentiate between the different types of believers?
Sure. And I'll say from the outset that I've not read the book that you mentioned, but I am familiar with Dr. Kassam and have read some of his other academic papers. You know, I come from a background as a psychiatrist with an interest in delusions, as I said. And one of the things that we talk about in delusions are called the cognitive dimensions of belief. So rather than just thinking about whether someone believes something or not, we think about these dimensions, which would be the degree of conviction. It's not black or white, all and none. Some people believe them more strongly than others, but have beliefs, generally speaking, more for others than others. Preoccupation is another cognitive dimension. There's plenty of things we happen to believe, but we're not spending, you know, hours and hours or a day or staying up all night thinking about those kind of beliefs. Distress is another cognitive dimension. You know, how much emotionality is connected to the belief, how much upset it causes us. So thinking about those cognitive dimensions is often how I think about conspiracy theory beliefs. I should say also from the outset that one way that we can distinguish conspiracy theory beliefs from delusions is that delusions, by definition, are beliefs that are held with intense and unassailable conviction, whereas conspiracy theory beliefs can be held with a much wider range of conviction. And so there are some people who endorse conspiracy theory beliefs as a sort of expression of a generalized sympathy to the idea, and there are others who are more bona fide, hardcore believers. And this point with QAnon was made, I think, very clearly in 2020 when there was a poll, and the poll found that about a fifth of the sample believe that that a global network tortures and sexually abuses children in satanic rituals. 18% of that sample also said that they believe that Trump was secretly preparing a mass arrest of government officials and celebrity. But those percentages, the 22% and the 18%, dropped to 12% and 6% respectively if they subtracted out the respondents who had only heard about those beliefs for the very first time during the survey. And so what that tells us is that, at least based on this poll, most of the folks who were endorsing QAnon beliefs hadn't even been aware of the beliefs before participating in the survey, which highlights this wide range of what people mean when they say whether or not they believe something. And so I will often liken this to belief in the Bible, where we have literalists who believe the Bible, you know, literally at the word, and then we have figuratists who believe in sort of more the spirit or the symbolism of the Bible. Anyway, so in light of all that, when I talk about conspiracy theory beliefs, like the kind that fall under the umbrella of QAnon, I like to model them according to what I call five stages of ideological commitment. And so this first stage, stage one, are non-believers who don't believe, who don't endorse the belief in question, in this case, QAnon. The next stage is made up of fence sitters. Fence sitters are mistrustful of mainstream narratives. They're looking for answers. They're starting to, quote, do their own research and exploring counter narratives. So they're coming into contact with conspiracy theory beliefs, but they're not fully committed to them yet. The next stage, which would be stage three, are the true believers who are indeed committed to the conspiracy theory beliefs. They've often shifted their allegiances to other folks who are either endorsing them or, as you pointed out, are producing them. And often that shift occurs to the exclusion of previous relationships. At the stage of the true believer, there's often a fusion of belief and identity, so that when beliefs are challenged, the believer feels attacked, often in a kind of visceral or even existential kind of way. Stage four are the activists. Activists are true believers, but for them, believing is not enough. They feel like they have to act on the beliefs, either to defend them or to advance some sort of cause. And this activism can be healthy, like when we go to a rally or a protest, but it can also lead one down a path that includes a willingness to participate or perpetrate violence or to sacrifice oneself for a cause. And then finally, stage five is sort of returning to the beginning. So this would be apostates who, for one reason or another, have decided they no longer believe, they've sort of left and separated from the movement, and they return to this stage of non-belief. So for me, that sort of stage-wise way of thinking about the intensity of belief, or what I call the ideological commitment, is really helpful from a mental health standpoint, because it really, I think, helps us predict how distressing a belief is going to become, how functionally impairing it's going to become, and to a certain extent, how likely it might be connected to non-normative behavior, including violence.
I'm curious to know whether you believe, from your expert opinion, whether QAnon would have been as massive as it became if it were not for the COVID-19 lockdowns and the global pandemic. Some would argue, because these factors existed in the time that it did, that we saw this movement, take into consideration that during lockdowns, people were at home, they couldn't interact with their loved ones. So, out of curiosity, if it were not for the pandemic and lockdowns, do you think that we would be speaking of QAnon right now?
Well, I will say, as someone who's very interested in beliefs and false beliefs, I don't like to predict the future. I also don't like to go back and say what would have happened if circumstances were different. But with that caveat stated, I certainly agree that a lot of people who do work in conspiracy theories feel that there's been a kind of perfect storm over the past couple of years, where a lot of different elements have contributed to this rise in conspiracy theories. So, for example, we know that conspiracy theories tend to blossom and flourish during times of a crisis, especially when people are feeling threatened, but then also don't have clear answers about that threat. And of course, the pandemic really symbolizes that situation, I think, very, very clearly. Now, why does that happen? Why are people drawn to conspiracy theories when they feel threatened and don't have answers? Because it seems a little counterintuitive. It's presumed that that happens because, even though the conspiratorial narratives are kind of upsetting, they at least offer a kind of tidy narrative. They offer an explanation. And then the explanation usually involves this sort of Manichean narrative, meaning this sort of cosmic good and bad forces. And you contribute the threat to the bad thing that, while scary, in theory is something we could do something about. So, for example, if you think about conspiracy theories related to the assassination of JFK. You know, that was a terrible national tragedy, very upsetting. And the explanation that it was just a random shooting by this lone gunman, that's actually very terrifying. But the idea that there was a conspiracy theory, that there was a conspiracy rather, actually kind of could be in theory comforting, because it's not just a random event, it's something that happened deliberately that we might have control over. Now, when I think about, or when I talk about conspiracy theories, I also like to talk about understanding them in this framework of mistrust and misinformation. And I think certainly we could say over the past 4 or 5 years now, coincident with the pandemic, that both mistrust and misinformation have been running rampant. Now, the interesting thing about QAnon is that it was and is a very internet-based phenomenon. And anecdotally, as you're suggesting, many people who found themselves down the proverbial QAnon rabbit hole talked about how during the pandemic, they were stuck at home, they were, you know, working from home or laid off from work, and a lot of their time was being spent online at the exclusion of their previous face-to-face interactions. So I do think it's fair to say that the pandemic fueled the fire of QAnon belief. At the same time, I think it's important to recognize that unlike something like flat earth beliefs, QAnon doctrine is really about politics, and where the focus is on this idea that we're in danger from child trafficking globalists operating within the so-called deep state, and that Donald Trump during his presidency was going to be the savior that drained the swamp and rooted out all the evil in government. And so even though I think the pandemic was really important with the growth of QAnon, it was also fueled by the lead up to the 2020 presidential election. And I think it was also fueled by a lot of the political unrest between the left and the right that occurred over that summer in response to the George Floyd killing by police. So I think it really was a kind of perfect storm that fueled things. And finally, I think we should also acknowledge that there was substantial media coverage about QAnon, particularly leading up to the election. And so I think some of that media coverage did spread awareness of the movement and may help to kind of give it a bit of a push in terms of a following.
I'm going to feel bad for the following question, because you just said that you don't want to predict the future, and that's exactly what I'm going to ask you to do. Being that it seems like Donald Trump will become the GOP nominee, and based on the well-documented increase in political extremism, do you believe that we might see a reemergence of QAnon? And I had asked this question to Mike Rothschild, who's an expert in conspiracy theories as well. And when I asked him that, he was like, no, because the movement needs to die, it needs to evolve. But I mean, if you look back in December, there was the reemergence of the Wayfair conspiracy theory, where instead of Wayfair, it was Etsy. And just recently, the candidate for Arizona, or I think she ran and then she lost, Carrie Lake, is having a fundraiser that's being hosted by QAnon believers. So based on that information, where do you see QAnon going from here?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like to predict the future. That's true. On the other hand, you know, when I talk about belief and false belief, I think the important thing when we talk about our beliefs is to acknowledge that sometimes we could be wrong about our beliefs. So if you ask me to predict the future, I'll do so while, you know, saying, hey, I could be wrong. You know, I think what's interesting about QAnon is that it already has evolved. You know, you could argue that QAnon really started with Pizzagate, and it started with this core belief about the deep state and a child trafficking ring and Comet Ping Pong, the pizzeria. And then during the pandemic, we saw QAnon sort of coalescing with a number of different other conspiratorial narratives, most notably things related to vaccines. And so we've already seen QAnon evolve. The other really interesting thing I think that happened with QAnon is that while its initial focus was really distinctly about American politics, as I mentioned, you know, this deep state and Donald Trump in particular, QAnon really did become a worldwide movement. So there are people in other countries who are holding QAnon banners. And it wasn't so much about Donald Trump or American politics per se. It had sort of evolved into or merged with this other broader populist movement. And I think that the rise in populism that we saw that in part got Donald Trump elected, that was another thing that fueled the QAnon movement. So I see the future of QAnon, you know, if, well, whether or not Donald Trump is elected, I think that QAnon will be relevant, but it's, I think it's going to morph and change. I mean, the other really interesting thing about QAnon is it was really born, of course, out of this guy Q. I mean, I say guy, but maybe it was a woman, maybe it was a AI, who knows? But, you know, it was fueled by Q, who was putting out these messages. And one thing that's happened is that just we haven't heard from Q in, what, two years, I think, at least now. So QAnon could certainly come back in its sort of more original form if Q were to return. But even in the absence of Q, I think we could see the sentiments that are expressed as part of that movement sort of morph and change into something else. And, you know, for that matter, if Donald Trump were to lose the election, we might likewise see a different kind of QAnon emerge than if he won the election, for example. So I wouldn't predict that it would just completely die out. I think it will continue to change depending on, you know, what the future holds.
I want to talk about the classification of what QAnon is. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I've had Mike Rothschild's on podcast. I've also had, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work, Dr. Brian Heloida, who also is a psychiatrist. Now, when I asked them what QAnon is, they gave me two different responses. Mike Rothschild told me that QAnon is a conspiracy theory of everything, that it has cult-like aspects, it has aspects of alternative gaming reality, it's a religious movement, a conspiratorial movement, an extremist movement. When I asked Dr. Heloida, he had told me that it doesn't have cult-like aspects because for it to be a cult, you need a cult leader, which, as you just noted, we don't know who the cult leader is, and the cult leader hasn't been responding for the last 2 years. QAnon is an online phenomenon. Cults tend to meet in person, and cults are small by nature, whereas QAnon is a global online phenomenon. And I tend to lean more with Dr. Heloida, because I think that in order to address QAnon effectively, you kind of need to identify it. And I give the example of diagnosis. When you diagnose someone with a mental disorder, you do that for two reasons. One, to identify the problem, and two, to offer an effective treatment. If you misdiagnose someone, the treatment won't be effective. I think the same thing is true when it comes to a social diagnosis for QAnon. If we just say that it has cult-like aspects or is religious-like or is ARG-like, it doesn't really address the problem. We also don't do that in a clinical setting where we assess a patient. We don't go like, oh, they have schizophrenia-like symptoms or delusional-like symptoms. We go with a specific diagnosis because that will determine the effectiveness of the intervention. So my question for you is, how would you categorize QAnon?
Well, I like your point about, you know, how it fits into how we think as mental health professionals, because I do think that we see the same phenomenon all the time, right? We see patients who have symptoms, and we try to group those symptoms together and then kind of stuff them into a diagnostic category. You know, this is what the DSM is for. But oftentimes we also have debates about, well, you know, if you have someone with emotional instability, is that due to bipolar disorder? Is it due to ADHD? Is it due to psychostimulant abuse? Is it due to personality disorder? So I do think we're seeing some of that with QAnon. It's a somewhat novel phenomenon, and there's this sort of urge to say, well, let's stick it into a specific box. Now, I'm sympathetic to some of that. I do think that one of the interesting and unique things about QAnon is this sort of alternate reality role-playing game aspect, as we talked about. So it really came out of the Q posting these sort of cryptic messages and then attracting this online following that called themselves Bakers, who were collecting these cue drops, or often called breadcrumbs, to kind of, you know, solve the mystery. And certainly people who got sucked into the QAnon movement talk about how that became a kind of intoxicating diversion, particularly during the pandemic. So for that sort of subset of QAnoners who are really the true believers who are spending time online, yeah, I think that was a very important part of that development. I think the religious part is also worth talking about, because I referenced before this idea of the Manichaean narrative, right? This narrative between this sort of ultimate battle between good and evil. And one thing that I think we've seen, somewhat surprisingly, has been this sort of convergence between QAnon and the Christian evangelical movement. And I don't think, I mean, I certainly would not have predicted back in 15, I guess, when Trump was running for president, I don't think I ever would have in a million years predicted that the Christian evangelical movement would embrace Donald Trump as their savior. And yet we saw that happen. And so there is this sort of religious element of the savior figures who's going to save us from this deep rooted evil that's pervasive in the country. Now, I am less sympathetic to the idea about QAnon being a cult for the reasons you mentioned. There's not really a defined leader. Even if you say Q was the leader, it wasn't as if he was rallying the troops and saying, let's meet here and let's do this and you have to do this. No, it was just sort of this random game that being played online. There's no real organizational structure. Cults are usually defined based on some sort of coercive element to membership, which is largely absent. So I'm less sympathetic to thinking about it as a cult. Anyway, so if you ask me how I think about QAnon, I tend to be more apt to categorize it as a political movement. I think it really does follow lock and step with the rise of populism we've seen, not just in the US, but across the globe. I think at the core, if you get away from the specific beliefs about a deep state and child trafficking and lizard people, if you kind of step back and look at what's really being talked about on a kind of symbolic level, we're really just talking about anti-establishment attitudes. Now, when we see conspiracy theories used in political movements, oftentimes what we hear is this sort of us and them narrative. And so oftentimes the them are these enemies from within. And I think that's really what I'm concerned about in terms of QAnon, is that it really is a political movement that's based in populism, and that we know from history that oftentimes there's a slippery slope from populism into authoritarianism that can be facilitated by conspiracy theory beliefs. So that's really how I think of it. At the same time, going back to my idea of the stages, I think we should recognize that QAnon represents a lot of things to a lot of people. And some people just have these sort of vague sympathies to it because they're, you know, politically aligned with other people who happen to be sympathetic to it. But that's different than the hardcore true believer or activist who's really, you know, showing up at rallies to, you know, witness the second coming of JFK Jr. or that kind of thing.
Now, during the pandemic, during lockdowns, and during the rise of QAnon, a lot of mainstream articles were citing that we were living in the golden age of conspiracy theories. But as you already know, if you look at the literature review, specifically by Joseph Uzinski, you'll find out that conspiratorial narratives have stayed persistently the same throughout the last, I'm going to say, 70 years. And so if conspiracy theories have stayed the same, do we have a problem with political extremism in relations to QAnon?
Well, just to qualify some of the research findings by Joe Uzinski, it is definitely correct that he says, you know, going back, I think, even a century, based on looking at primarily newspaper articles, you know, over that time period, that it is probably not fair or accurate to say that we're living in a golden age of conspiracy theories, because the amount of conspiracies that are out there, and, you know, the number of people who endorse them, clearly this is not like the most that there's ever been. I mean, human beings have believed in conspiracy theories for millennia. And if we go back in recent history to, let's say, the McCarthy era during the Red Scare, I mean, that was the core of that movement was conspiracy theories. So it's not as if our current time is unprecedented in history. At the same time, what Yasinski did find, and other researchers have found, is that there has been an ebb and flow. There have been times where they're more prominent, and there's been times when they're less prominent. And so I do think that it's not just like there's a steady level that's always been there. I think we are living at a time where conspiracy theories may be more prevalent. It's just not that they're the most prevalent that they've ever been, the way some people claim. Now, the other thing I talk about beyond prevalence is the consequence. Because if you look at previous conspiracy theories like flat earthers, or even things like the JFK assassination, you could argue that the belief in that conspiracy theory didn't have a lot of consequences. Whereas I think you could make an argument with current conspiracy theory belief that the beliefs are pretty consequential. I mean, if you think about conspiracy theories related to the pandemic, which are rooted in, you know, anti-vaccine sentiments, or if we think about conspiracy theories related to climate change denialism, or if we think about conspiracy theories related to the idea that the election was rigged and that our, you know, fundamental democratic institutions of voting are corrupt. I mean, these are really consequential things. So I do sometimes like to say that we could argue that we're living in a dark age of conspiracy theories, maybe not a golden age where they're more prevalent, but a dark age in the sense that they kind of matter right now. At the same time, I think one of the things that's not as well established with Yasinski's research and other research is back to this idea of the continuum of conviction. We don't really know from past surveys or looking at New York Times editorials the way Yasinski did, just how much people believe. We have more markers of general agreement with conspiracy theory beliefs. So it is possible that the intensity of belief could be more so now than it has previously. We just don't know that for sure.
I want to take things to a clinical perspective. Now, when it comes to understanding conspiracy theories, there's controversy on whether we should look at psychopathologization to explain certain narratives. Some argue that if you psychopathologize conspiracy theories, that you're not addressing the psychosocial factors that contribute to people that believe in such narratives. People that believe in conspiracy theories do so because their psychological needs aren't being met. They need a quick explanation of a simplistic explanation of things to get a sense of safety. At the same time, one can argue that there are elements of anxiety disorders or depression that can contribute to people being susceptible to conspiracy theories. From your expert opinion, where do you fall in this discussion?
Well, it's certainly a very interesting question, and to a certain extent, there's a lot of question marks that remain to be answered about this sort of intersection of conspiracy theory belief and mental illness. But I will say from the get-go that I would want to make clear from the start that I don't see conspiracy theory belief as a symptom of mental illness. Conspiracy theories, as we talked about earlier, aren't delusions. And so we shouldn't think of people who believe in conspiracy theories as mentally ill, delusional, crazy, unhinged, you know, all the pejorative aspects that we hear about all the time. And another thing that should be made very clear is that polls over the past decade, not just in the US, but around the world, have consistently showed that a substantial majority of people believe in at least one conspiracy theory. So if we're going to start, you know, invoking mental illness, then, you know, we're talking about this idea that basically all of us are mentally ill. You know, as I like to say, if we go back, you know, 4 or 5 years ago or so, you know, most of the U.S. Population believed in at least one conspiracy theory, either that Donald Trump was in cahoots with Putin and was, you know, an asset of Russia, or that Russiagate, the whole, you know, so-called witch hunt, that was the conspiracy theory. So, and it really shows, and I think Joseph Yasinski's research showed very clearly the conspiracy theories are often, conspiracy theory belief rather, are often predicted by our political alignment. And we tend to look at kind of the other side and go, oh, that sounds crazy, or that's a conspiracy theory, without being to look at it, being able to look at ourselves and acknowledge that we have many of those same kinds of beliefs and suspicions. Now, having said that, if we now talk about, you know, what role could mental health professionals have in working with people who have conspiracy theory beliefs, I mean, I completely agree. If we listen anecdotally to people who have fallen down the rabbit hole, so to speak, they often describe distress, anxiety. And a lot of that distress and anxiety comes from the conspiratorial narrative that they've embraced. We've also read a lot in recent years about how falling down that rabbit hole results in a fracturing of social relationships. You know, Karen Douglas, who's one of the world experts on conspiracy theories, talks a lot about this as a focus of her recent work. So I think there's clearly negative impacts on mental health that can happen when people become more ideologically committed. And part of the reason I like to think about conspiracy theory belief according to these stages of ideological commitment is I think that there could be different interventions depending on that level of commitment. And we can think of this similarly to like when we do cognitive behavioral therapy with depressed patients. We have core cognitive distortions that are distinct from delusions, and we can work with people to look at the evidence and, you know, decide whether or not that belief is real or not. You know, the conundrum there, of course, is that we often have in the setting of conspiracy theories these sort of two alternate realities where the ability to collaboratively look at the evidence is sort of challenged by first having to agree on what your informational sources are. Anyway, you know, whenever I talk about the possibility of using psychotherapy for a conspiracy theory belief, I always mention the joke that asks, how does it go? You know, what? How many psychiatrists does it take to screw in a light bulb? And the answer is just one, but the light bulb has to really want to change. So that's the other thing to keep in mind about conspiracy theory beliefs. Psychotherapy could be helpful, but it's only helpful for people who are help-seeking. And I don't think that the vast majority of people who have conspiracy theory beliefs are, you know, seeking to change, have their minds changed, or to have their beliefs challenged. So I should say, too, that I agree with what you're saying, which is I don't really see conspiracy theory belief as a matter of individual psychopathology. What I do see it as a symptom of a sick society that's plagued by these sort of twin maladies of mistrust and misinformation. So there's this, you know, familiar quotation that's variably attributed to people like R.D. Lang or maybe Tabitha Sass that talks about insanity is a sane response to an insane society. And I think that's a bad explanation for mental illness, but I think it's a good phrase that encapsulates what conspiracy theory belief is all about. It's a sort of sane response to an insane society where mistrust and misinformation are running quite rampant. So in that sense, I agree with you. The real solution to combating conspiracy theory belief and addressing mistrust and misinformation isn't something that's going to be achievable on an individual level. It's something that we have to look at on a societal level or a national level. And that might sound like, oh my gosh, that's insurmountable. But all we have to do is look to the example of Finland, that over the past 5 years or so has established this national, really educational campaign from, you know, early school years into, you know, geriatric age, so across the lifespan, that is really making the citizens of that country better consumers of information, more able to ferret out what's true or not true, more able to recognize what's a conspiracy theory narrative that's not backed up by evidence. And so so I think we have good evidence that it can be done on a large scale. We just have to have the political will and you know, we have to do it.
Yeah, I certainly agree with everything you said. I also think that, you know, from a social work perspective, that even though we are trained to look at things from the at the macro level, there's not a lot of social workers that are following the route that I'm taking when it comes to addressing extremism and conspiracy theories. The other thing is that conspiracy theories, while they impact the individual, the believer, they also have consequences for loved ones. And I would argue that perhaps those are the individuals that do need the therapeutic help, because we have programs for substance abuse, for example, for family members who lost loved ones to alcoholism. So perhaps something similar can be developed when it comes to conspiracism, but time will tell how that will work and whether such program will get the proper funding. So my last question, and this is just a curveball, and feel free not to answer, but I'm just curious, since we both established that a majority of Americans believe in a conspiracy theory, I am curious to know if you yourself are a believer of a small conspiracy theory. I've asked this question to researchers in the field of conspiracy theory, and they've shared some. I'm just curious to know if you feel comfortable sharing. If not, you don't feel pressure to answer.
Well, I mean, it's really a great question. And it goes back to what I said about you. I think we do have to be better about looking in the mirror and acknowledging where we're sometimes led astray, rather than always just imagining that it's our ideological opposites who are the ones who are, believing crazy things. So my gut reaction is to say, well, I think of myself as more of the non-believer who doesn't tend to buy into these things. At the same time, I think one of the really great illustrations of what we're dealing with today, and I sort of made reference to it, this idea that several years ago, half the country believed that Donald Trump was in cahoots with Putin and was a stooge of the Kremlin, and the other half believed that there was this sort of witch hunt and this sort of false, investigation. So I remember about that time that I had read two articles. And I don't remember either the authors or where they were published, but I think one of them was published in, I'm going to say it was the New Yorker, and another was published by a more conservative paper. And they were really talking about the Steele dossier. And the more liberal, the New Yorker author, was really putting a lot of stock into the Steele dossier and saying how, it seemed very credible. And the conservative writer, of course, was basically saying, it was BS. And I remember reading both of those narratives. They're both long-form narratives. They're very detailed. They seem to be very well researched. And I remember saying, gosh, they seem like, which one do I believe? But, hey, I tend to lean more liberal, although I think of myself as middle of the road, but I lean more towards liberal. And it just seemed like that New Yorker narrative was more compelling and correct. And of course, we now know that it wasn't, right? The Steele dossier was largely a fabrication. So I think for sure, I think all of us have the potential to kind of slip it down those rabbit holes and be duped by misinformation because of where our what I call epistemic trust or mistrust lies, or how much we believe in different sources of information. So that would be the one that I think I, at least to a certain extent, bought into, this idea about the Steele dossier.
When it comes to me, I am the believer of the Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself. I think that's the one that's socially acceptable without being considered, too in the fringe. But well, anyway, Joe, I want to thank you so much for your time. The conversation that we had was amazing, very informative. Before I let you go, can you let the listeners know where they can find your work?
Oh, sure. So I have a blog on psychology today. It's called Psych Unseen. You can find me on Twitter with that same handle, Psych Unseen. Hopefully I'll have a forthcoming book out at the end of the year, beginning of next year, called False, and which is really about the psychology of false belief. So hopefully that will come out soon.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm definitely going to put that on my, on my to-do list to get the book, and hopefully I can have you on again to discuss it. So anyway, again, thank you so much for your time. And like I tell everyone that I have on this the podcast, thank you so much for your research, for your contribution in this field. As a graduate student that's studying political extremism and conspiracy theories, your work has been beneficial for my understanding on this issue. So thank you so much.
All right. Well, thanks for having me. I'd be happy to come back.
Hi there. I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Dr. Joseph Pierre and found our discussion informative in gaining a deeper understanding of the QAnon movement. I want to take this time to make a correction on my part. If you've been listening to my podcast for a while, you'll know that I often use Zim Kazam's conspiracy theory model of understanding the different types of believers. Well, in researching his book, I realized that the conspiracy theory distributor is never mentioned in his book. I believe that I unintentionally added that to his motto, and in doing so, misrepresented his work. Now, I actually prefer including the conspiracy theory distributor because I feel like it separates between a person that accepts a conspiracy theory to be true from one that is beginning to spread the conspiracy theory with friends and families with the attempt to convince that the conspiracy theory is true. So going forward, I'll continue to use this motto, but will credit Dr. Kazam as someone who helped influence my categorization of conspiracy believers. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to subscribe and leave me a 5-star review. By doing so, you help expose this podcast to people who might be interested in conspiracy theories and extremism when in politics. If you're listening on any other platform, be sure to subscribe to get more analysis on the conspiratorial mindset. You can follow me on Instagram and Thread at The Social Chemist. You can find me on Substack for my newsletter. The references for this episode and Dr. Joseph Pierre's work can be found in the show notes below. Be sure to share today's episode to have some interesting discussions about the psychosocial assessment of QAnon. If you're interested in similar discussions with experts, be sure to check on the recommended episodes provided in the description of today's episode. So with that being said, take care, be safe, and question everything with logic.